We're studying from the Psalms, of course, and there is a reason for our doing so. We want to be familiar with this section of Old Testament history, the poetry that is involved in it, and have the appreciation for the things that are revealed in this great book. That we should, to be encouraged by it, to be comforted by it, and to have a greater understanding of who God is. His mercy, His compassion, His love, His deliverance, His wrath, and His judgment upon those who are wicked. And also to have a better understanding of Christ in prophecy. There are many of the Psalms that are considered messianic, and considering the time frame in which they are written, we ought to be impressed with the details of those. We will study a number of those as we get to it. And then we want to see how that these prophecies, not just simply the messianic prophecies, but there are a number of Psalms that are quoted in the New Testament, and see how that the quotations themselves and the detail in which they are given help us to understand the inspiration of Scripture. And I think if we can do that, it will be a great accomplishment to us. I was talking to some earlier that in preparing material to study the Psalms, to be able to, at least on my part, organize my thoughts in a way that will be helpful to us has been somewhat difficult. But that's what we're going to try to do, is to categorize the Psalms instead of doing a verse-by-verse study. That would not be practical as far as the time frame is concerned. So we want to try to categorize the Psalms, and we'll not be studying all of the Psalms, but we will be studying a number of them, and noting that some of the things that are presented in some of the Psalms would be representative of other Psalms, so we'll make some references to them, but not necessarily study in great detail. Now, we left off, and I don't like doing this because you never have the same audience, and I know I do it more than perhaps I should have a to-be-continued study. Carolyn characterizes my sermons by saying we just never hear the end of it. And that's probably accurate because there's so much to say. But the point being is that it's going to be difficult in a study of this kind to complete segment for segment for segment within the time frame that we have. So many of these are going to have to be continued. And even the short psalm, the first one that we're studying, Psalms 1, we've left it kind of midstream, but we did leave it at a good breaking point. So I want to look at the psalm. And Randy Childs, if you would, I pick on you so much, would you read Psalms 1 for us? Just 6 verses, so it should be helpful to get our thoughts together.
Psalm 1. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by the streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and in whatever he does he prospers. The wicked are not so, but they are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand at the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish.
Was commenting some before class, or before everybody got here, that a lot of the things that are presented in the Psalms, I think that we overthink. We want to go through a verse-by-verse study, and keep in mind they're a psalm, and they're presented in that way. And to isolate each word, sometimes that's helpful to get the definition of words, but sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees. We focus on one thing so much so that we don't see the thought that's presented. This psalm breaks itself down basically into three points. The man who is blessed is the righteous man. He's blessed as we see his character. He's blessed as far as prosperity is concerned. And one of the things that we noted on that is we're not talking about physical prosperity. This is not serve the Lord so you get rich kind of as a scheme. But here's the man that is content. He's provided the things necessary to be satisfied. And then the second point we see is the condition of the unrighteous. So we've got a contrast, obviously, in this passage. And then we see the final contrast between these two ways. Isn't that simple? You can choose this way, you can choose that way, but if you choose this way, here's what happens. If you choose this way, then here's what happens. And so we've noted time and time again that we've all got choices. We noted that when Joshua brought the children of Israel into the promised land, he said, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, or the gods of your fathers that are beyond the river, but as for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah. Period. That's stated. And similar thought is presented by Elijah the prophet. How long go ye limping between the two? If Jehovah be God, serve him. If Baal be God, serve him. You've got a choice to make. And we're all familiar with Matthew 7, 13 and 14. The narrow gate and the straight gate, you get to choose. One leads to destruction, one leads to eternal life. Simple choice, but sometimes complicated in application. Now, what we want to see in Psalms 1, we've talked about a good little bit of this in Psalms 1, verses 1 and 2. We've seen the man that is blessed. We've talked about how that he doesn't walk in the counsel of the wicked. He doesn't stand in the way of sinners. He doesn't sit in the seat of scoffers. He's careful about his associations. And his delight, then, is in the law of Jehovah, and he meditates on it all the time. Now, here's what he's like, beginning in verse 3. He shall be like a tree that's planted by the streams of water, that bringeth forth its fruit in its seasons, whose leaf also doth not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. That's important to us. In this area that we live in the desert, I dare say most of you have traveled out across the desert and noticed a beautiful green cottonwood tree. You ever seen that? What does that tell you right away? Water somewhere. Yeah, water somewhere. And when you amplify that, this man that's righteous, he'll be like a tree planted by the streams of water, which indicates that the tree is going to flourish. Here's the righteous man. He'll bring forth fruit in its seasons, and his leaf doesn't wither. Now, a tree that doesn't get water, it's going to die. And the righteous man, he has what he needs in order to live. Now, whatever comes around him, here's the rub. When you read in the Sermon on the Mount, rather extensively from Matthew 5 through Matthew 7, you read a lot of information about how you should live your life. But I want to call your attention to the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew chapter 7, in verses 24 through 25, we'll begin there and drop on down through verse 27 as we make application. He said, everyone therefore that heareth these words of mine and doeth them shall be likened unto a wise man who built his house upon the rock, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon the rock. Now when you take that thought back to Psalm 1, the man who's blessed is compared to the man who hears these words of mine and does them. Isn't that simple? Now you'll note from Matthew 5 coming forward to this point, there are a lot of principles that are dealt with. And Jesus said, you've heard it said this, but I say unto you. Now if you want to live a righteous life and reap the benefits from it, then it's your choice. The wise man is the man that hears these words of mine and does them. Let's underscore that in our thinking, because all of us, from even little bitty kids, we've been brought up in the Bible classes singing the song that the wise man built his house upon the rock. And we're familiar with that song because it comes from this passage. But what is the application? The wise man is the man that hears what I have to say and does it. Now the foolish man, when we talk about the foolish man who built his house upon the sand, and then when the rains came and the floods descended and the winds blew and smote upon that house, verse 27, it fell and great was the fall thereof. Now who's he? He's the man who hears these words of mine and does them. Now that's what the psalmist is trying to tell us. That's what Joshua was trying to say. That's what Elijah was saying. And that's what the Lord said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7, 13 and 14. Now, if you want to make that choice, then great. But what will hearing these words of mine and doing them do for you in times of trouble, times of temptation, times of affliction, times of difficulty and adversity, when things are not good. You hear these words of mine and do them. You're looking beyond the present now. You're looking to what He has promised later. And it gives you perspective. Case in point, turn in your Bible, if you will, to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. This particular passage, and you all know that I like to study on a timeline because I think it gives us a perspective that's quite important to us. Just by way of review, about when in Paul's life, and I'm not asking for a date necessarily, but the chain of events, when was 2 Corinthians written and from where? Who wants that? All right. It was written from Macedonia. That's right. Second missionary journey. That's right. And we know that Paul has traveled through Asia. Very good. Traveled through Asia and up into Macedonia. He wrote from Asia, from Ephesus, the First Corinthian letter. Third preaching tour? Okay. Yeah, it is. It's the third preaching tour because he was arrested in Jerusalem at the conclusion of the third preaching tour. That is correct, not the second. Third preaching tour. Thank you for the correction. But we know that he was traveling from Asia, from Ephesus in particular, where he'd written the first Corinthian letter, up to Troas. And then he went up into Macedonia where he wrote the second Corinthian letter. Now, often in our studies of Bible authority, in particular the subject of benevolence and that sort of thing, we make this point because it's crucial to see where he's going and when and all of those kind of things. But in the first Corinthian letter, he's admonished the Corinthians about a lot of different subjects. Almost in every chapter you see a new problem. But in the 16th chapter, it's regarding the collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem. And then he writes the second Corinthian letter from Macedonia, revisiting that subject. And that's why we get the order of these. In 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, he's telling them to give bountifully, cheerfully, as they have been instructed. And he's coming to collect that. Now, in the book of Romans, in the 15th chapter, we see that he is writing to the Romans from Corinth. He's on his way to Jerusalem with these funds that have been collected. And one of the things that we want to make note of here is, as he has written, and we're about to read 2 Corinthians, we see that he suffered a lot of things. Just a laundry list of things. And if you want to look at the list, it's in 2 Corinthians 11, beginning in verse 23 through the next several verses. Would urge you to read that. But he hadn't been arrested yet. He's still on his way to Jerusalem. The Roman imprisonment hasn't happened yet. So the events in Jerusalem haven't happened yet. So the timeline is important. But look at what he says at this point in time, prior to many of the sufferings that he was yet to endure. In 2 Corinthians 4, beginning in verse 16, he says, "Wherefore we faint not, but though our outward man is decaying, yet our inward man is renewed day by day, for our light affliction, which is for the moment, worketh for us more and more exceedingly an eternal weight of glory. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." And then beginning in chapter 5, there's not a thought division here. Chapter divisions are unfortunate sometimes. "For we know that if the earthly house of our tabernacle be dissolved, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." And then he develops that thought to suggest that he groans for that. He longs for that. Now, having said that, knowing the laundry list that's presented in chapter 11, verse 23 and following, and noting that he calls that light affliction, it's all a matter of perspective, isn't it? In comparison to what?
Eternity.
Eternity, yeah. In fact, in Romans chapter 8 and verse 18, he said, "For the things of the sufferings of this life are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed to us." So when we look at Psalms chapter 1, I want us to see that thought. The man who is a righteous man, he's like a tree that's planted by the streams of water that bringeth forth its fruit in its seasons, whose leaf also doth not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. Here's the righteous man. He's blessed in the things that he does. Now, does that have a little bit of bearing on when you suffer loss or affliction or temptation or persecution, to know that there's something better? We'll get through this. I was talking with Darrell Forrest last night a little bit about Galen and that sort of thing that some of you are aware of. And Darrell was talking about some of the things that we suffer in this life. And I said, yeah, but this too shall pass. And if we ever forget that, all we see is the here and now. Yeah, there's sufferings here and now. There's difficulties here and now. But if that's all we see, how discouraging is that? You see, you can reach the point of despair if that's all you think about. And though Paul suffered all these things, the Lord said that we would, but the wise man is the man that hears what I have to say. And he looks past these things. There's something better. Just keep looking past. We'll get through this. Okay? So I told Darrell, this too shall pass. One way or the other, it will pass. Now, as you look at the contrast, whatsoever he shall do shall prosper, Paul said. And Paul's writing to the young preacher Timothy, and those of you that are studying with us on Tuesday night are well familiar with this. 1 Timothy 4, verse 8, he said, godliness is profitable unto all things, having promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come. Now, I want you to think about that in light of what the psalmist said. The psalmist said that the righteous man shall prosper. Does that mean he's going to be rich in this life? No, that's not the point. No, that's not the point. But if you live a righteous life, there's blessings for you even now. There's blessings for you even now. But even beyond that, it has the promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come. Paul, writing from a Roman prison, said in Philippians 4 that I can do all things in him that strengtheneth me. He said, I've learned in whatever state I'm in to be content. Does that mean that it's going to be pleasant? Well, no. But writing from a Roman prison, he had learned, I'll get through this. This too shall pass. Now, if we ever lose sight of that, we're messing up, folks. Yes.
You quoted Romans 8:18, but if you drop down to 28, that's a pretty good one too. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. It's the providential verse.
Yeah.
You'll be provided for.
Yeah.
If you're serving God, He'll watch after you.
Yeah. Yeah.
No matter what.
Was it the prophet Isaiah, I think? I may be mistaken. Said that he had never seen the righteous man begging bread. Or was that Job that said that? I've forgotten. Some of you can find that readily. But the point is well taken. You'll have the things that you need. That don't mean you'll be a wealthy person in terms of material wealth. But you won't be in want. You'll have the things that you need. So here's our point from Psalms 1. You serve the Lord. You be faithful to the Lord. You're like a tree that's planted by the rivers of planted by the river, you'll flourish. Now that's the point. Now, as this thought continues, look, if you will, at the next point. He said, the wicked are not so. No, the wicked are not like that. Nothing like that. In verse 4, he said, the wicked are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind driveth away. Now, I have a picture on the board because I think this is interesting how we have processed in time as far as mechanical things that help us with our labor. If you had to harvest a 50-acre field of wheat, now I know wheat farmers, 50 acres is nothing. We're talking just in one field probably today, 250, 300-acre wheat field. But suppose you had to harvest 50 acres of wheat. You had to do it by hand. And in order to do that, you would take a sieve, I think it's called, and you'd go through the field like this. We had one of those things. And you'd go through the field like this. And you would take then the wheat that you'd cut and you'd put it into shocks, tie it up. And then you got to find a way to get it to the threshing floor. So you put it on a wagon, you take it to the threshing floor, and then you have the oxen walk over it and 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 over it. And then you get out there with a fork and you throw it up in the air like this man's doing. And you pick a day when there's a little bit of breeze to do that, and the wind takes the chaff that way, and the wheat then falls down here and the grain falls in the stack. And so the chaff, you get rid of that, that's no good. But the grain is what you want to keep. Now what if you had 50 acres of wheat and you had to do that to it? It'd take a while. Yeah, it'd take a while. But the point being, this is how they used to do it, and the psalmist is making reference to that. They didn't have a combine to go through the wheat field that took care of all that for you, you see. And so the wicked man, he says he's not like that. He's like the chaff which the wind driveth away. Now what's going to ultimately happen to the chaff? What do they do with the chaff? Burn it. Yeah, burn it. Now some of you who are from the Midwest may recall when the farmers would go through with a combine, and it does a lot of this work for you. It will separate the wheat and the chaff, and the wheat goes into the bin on the combine, and then he pulls up the side of a wagon, dumps it into the wagon, takes it to the grain barn or wherever they're going to put it. But the chaff is spit out behind the combine. And what do they just then do with that? They burn it. They don't till it in. But Donna and I have seen it many times. They'll tie on a tire behind a tractor and set it on fire and drive around the wheat field and burn that 200-300 acre field of wheat, burning up the chaff, getting rid of that, because the harvest is now in the barn. And here's a man doing it by hand. Here's the point. The wicked are like this. The wicked is like the chaff that's driven by the wind. He's just wasting away. His life is not going to be profitable or productive, because there's going to come a time when he'll have to stand before God and give an account of all the wasted effort. And so verse 5 then tells us, therefore the wicked shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. Now we know that there is a day of judgment. All of us are going to stand before God and give an account of the things that we've done in this life, whether they be good or bad. The wise man said that in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. We know that's so. And the sinner, he's going to face that unprepared like the chaff, and he'll be forever destroyed. Now, I think sometimes we get our mind bent on that too. We think if we do bad things, then to be destroyed is something going to be like just boom, you're burned up and it's all done and over. No. No end to it. No end to it. And so here's the wicked man. Now the choice is yours. Which one do you want to be? The wicked man will not stand in the judgment. So what do we learn? The only person that's going to stand before the Lord in the judgment is the man that is obedient. The man who's watchful. The man who's righteous. Yeah.
This is sort of a fine point, but I'm imagining there could be some confusion because the word stand is used in two ways.
Yes.
If we are presented before the Lord, that's where we're standing in front of the Lord for the judgment or whatever the arrangement is. But to say the wicked shall not stand, it doesn't mean they don't appear. It means they don't have a leg to stand on. They will not come out well.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He'll not survive. Yeah, it won't come out well. No good end to this. And I have on the board Romans chapter 3, beginning of verse 10, and I've got a reason for having that there, as you might imagine, because the reason why people make this choice that's presented in Psalms 1 is stated in Romans chapter 3, and in fact, a number of times. And I want you to look at it. Romans chapter 3. If you'll begin reading at verse 10, it says, as it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They have all turned aside. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not so much as one. Their throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their way, And the way of peace they have not known. And then the reason. Verse 18. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Why would somebody make the choice that the psalmist is describing here in Psalm 1 when the end is no good? What's his view of the judgment? What's his view of the end?
It doesn't exist.
It don't matter. Yeah, doesn't exist. Now, that gives reason, doesn't it, to make a wise choice. The wise man hears these words of mine and does them. All right, any questions or comments just here? All right, well, let's look at the last part of this. It tells us the way of the wicked shall perish. The verse 6 beginning, Jehovah knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked shall perish. We're going to be looking at some more passages, in particular in our study this, hopefully this morning, Psalm 139, where we learn that the Lord knows what you're doing. There's no place you can go and escape the knowledge or the vision of God. He knows what you're doing. We sing, sometimes the song used to, I don't recall us singing it here recently, there's an all-seeing eye watching you. And so it's a good song, but it denotes the very thing that we're talking about. The Lord knows. He knows the way of the righteous, and He knows the way of the wicked. And the way of the righteous, they'll live, and the way of the wicked shall perish. Now that has been historically true. We could look at the passages that are on the board if you'd like, the 23rd Psalm that we're so familiar with. But the Lord is not like us. Sometimes we can be deceived. You've been deceived? Sometimes we see what we want to see. And sometimes we get it wrong. The Lord don't. He don't ever get it wrong. Now, does that give you reason to read Psalm 1 with the idea of making a wise choice? Here's the righteous man, here's the wicked man, and you see the ultimate end of each one. The idea of the way of the wicked, he'll perish, is ultimate ruin. Now, that ought not be strange to us because we've just studied about that in the book of Revelation. In Revelation 21, I'd like for you to look at all of these passages, particularly maybe 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. But if you'll notice in Revelation 21, specifically in verse 8, there the writer says, "But for the fearful and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and fornicators and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part shall be in the lake of fire," or the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. We're all familiar with that. That's not a very desirable end. But that's the point that the psalmist is making. The way of the wicked shall perish. Now, sometimes Psalm 73 is going to be one that I'd like for us to study in some detail. But in the beginning of Psalm 73, written by Asaph, we know that he's got a problem, a dilemma. When he looks at his life and compares it to the lives of the wicked, he doesn't understand. I look at the life of the wicked man over here. He doesn't care about God. He doesn't try to do the right things. And he seems everything he puts his hand to goes well for him. And then I look at my life. And I've sacrificed. And I've tried and done all these things to try to be obedient to the Lord. And I don't understand because that doesn't seem to be working for me. I'm not flourishing. I'm not apparently as successful in life as I want to be. But the wicked man over here, he don't care about God, and things seem to be going well for him. And the psalmist stated it quite well when he said, "When I thought on it, it troubled me." It was just too much. He couldn't seem to work that out. And then the next verse says, until what? Went into the sanctuary of the Lord. That's right. Now I kind of got it figured out. Because when I went there, the wicked man, though it appears things went well for him, the judgment's not good for him. And though it appears in my life things are not going well for me, but I'm serving the Lord. And in the end, things will be well. Randy?
that, the other half of that verse, until I came into the sanctuary of God, then I perceived their end.
Yeah. 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 So what I want us to see is that many of the principles stated in the Psalms, they're stated over and over and over and over. And what do you generally do when you're trying to teach little ones? You say the same thing over and over and over and over. And that's what the psalmist does. Okay? So it's helpful to us, I think, to see these principles. Any questions or comments just here? All right, we've looked at Psalms 1. Now I'm going to change gears just a little bit, and we're going to flip way over to Psalms 100. Psalms 100. We're going to try to get a little bit better organized, or I am, in our study. And Psalm 100, I'd like for you to go back, and maybe this afternoon or between now and next week or sometime, read Psalms 95 through Psalms 100. Psalms 95 through Psalms 100. We're just going to look at Psalms 100 because this becomes a conclusion of this segment of Psalms of praise. And so we're going to look at this in a little bit of detail. All right? But we're not going to go back and study Psalm 95 through 100. This is going to be a cross-section, if you please, of some of the Psalms that are Psalms of praise. And Randy, can I pick on you again, please, to read Psalm 100 for me?
Psalm 100. Shout joyfully to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before Him with joyful singing. Know that the Lord Himself is God. It is He who has made us, and not we ourselves. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture. Enter His gates with thanksgiving and His courts with praise. Give thanks to Him. Bless His name. For the Lord is good. His loving kindness is everlasting, and His faithfulness to all generations.
All right, thank you. You note right away, and we've talked in our introductory remarks of the Psalms, to note the headings that are up above them, and we note that all men are exhorted to praise God. This is a psalm of thanksgiving and praise. And so we want to note that as we introduce this particular psalm. And you see it on the board. I wanted you to read it from the New American Standard Translation. This is the American Standard Translation that we have on the board. But the point being is, make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before His presence with singing. I want to talk about that just a little bit for this reason. What we are doing this morning ought not ever become drudgery. Ought never become drudgery. Now, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands because I don't want to know that. Some things I just don't want to know. But do you ever find yourself on Sunday morning saying, oh, I'm awful tired. Had a hard weekend, had a hard week. Sure would be nice just to sleep in this morning. But today is the Lord's day. Oh, and I've got to get up. Got to go to church today. And that seems to characterize the attitudes, unfortunately, of so many. We serve the Lord, but we're not excited about doing it. Now, I want you to look with me at this text that we've got on the board from Deuteronomy chapter 12. It ought to be something that gets our attention. Deuteronomy chapter 12. Read with me in verses 11 and 12. Deuteronomy 12, verses 11 and 12. We're going to make an application later in Deuteronomy. But in Deuteronomy 12, beginning in verse 11, the writer said, then it shall come to pass that to the place which Jehovah your God shall choose to cause His name to dwell there, thither ye shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes and the heave offerings of your hand, and all your choice vows which you vow unto Jehovah. And ye shall rejoice before Jehovah your God, ye and your sons and your daughters and your men servants. Let your maidservants and the Levites that is within your gates, for as much as he hath no portion nor inheritance with you. Now, I know that we could take the time to discuss the chapter, but I don't want to do that. I simply want to emphasize these two verses. What's the attitude with which Moses requires these people to worship God?
Joyful.
Be joyful about doing that. Now, what if you don't? Turn over to chapter 28. chapter 28. Now, you'll recognize chapter 28 through 30. It ought to ring a bell to you because we note the blessings and the curses from the law in Deuteronomy chapter 28 through chapter 30. But in Deuteronomy chapter 28, look specifically in verse 47 beginning. 28 verse 47. It says, because thou servest not Jehovah thy God with joyfulness and with gladness of heart, by reason of the abundance of all things, therefore shalt thou serve thine enemies that Jehovah shall send against thee in hunger and in thirst and in nakedness and in want of all things. And he shall put a yoke of iron upon thy neck until he have destroyed thee. Now drop down to verse 52, get the highlight. It says, and they shall besiege thee in all thy gates until thy high and fortified walls come down, wherein thou trustest throughout all thy land. And they shall besiege thee in all thy gates throughout all the land which Jehovah thy God hath given thee. Now you sum that up for me. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, he said, I want you to worship and serve me with joy. Now, if you can't do that, when you look at all of the things that I've done for you, you're not excited about serving me, then what?
You'd be destroyed.
I'm sorry?
Consequences
are going to follow. Yeah, if you can't serve me and be joyful about it and consider the abundance of all the things that I've given you, then you can serve your enemies. Now, if you serve your enemies, are you going to have the abundance of the things that I've given you? Well, no, you see, you're going to be slaves. You'll be taken into captivity, and that's what happened to them. Now, do you find that interesting that Moses is telling them that long before they ever came into the promised land? You can be excited about serving me because of all the things I've done for you. I had somebody ask me one time, what did God ever do for me? Oh. Well, if you set aside the temporal blessings, you just set that aside. You can answer it in just one sentence. He gave his son. Now, if that don't prompt you to be a little bit excited about serving the Lord, then I don't know what it takes. Now, were they always faithful? No, they were not faithful. Did they have some excitement about serving the Lord? Well, at times, but then many times they did not. And they were taken into captivity. The northern 10 tribes were taken by the Assyrians. The southern 2 tribes of Benjamin and Judah were taken by the Babylonians. And they were told by Moses in that great context of chapter 28 through 30 of the book of Deuteronomy that when you wake up, when you repent, I'll bring you back into this land when you serve me. And so they did. 70 years of Babylonian captivity prevailed, and at the end of which we have had a recent study about Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai and Zechariah and some of the Old Testament prophets that led them in the return to the land. But then as you come to the book of Micah, Micah tells us some details about their worship. Now you'd like to think that if you look at what they were when they were coming into the land, the great victories and the blessings that God gave them as long as they were faithful. And then when they became unfaithful, they did not serve God with joy. He brought up other nations and took them captive. And now they've seen the light, right? They know that what we did is wrong. And so now we're privileged to come back into the land. Oh, but we met with opposition. Ezra chapters 1 through 4. And so we have not rebuilt the temple. We have not rebuilt the walls. We've not restored temple worship. And now then, as Malachi writes, we've got the temple in place. Haggai has helped with that. We've got the walls rebuilt. Nehemiah has helped with that. And now here's Malachi, and look at what he writes in Malachi chapter 1.
You want Malachi or Micah?
I want Malachi. Malachi chapter 1. Look, if you will, please. Beginning in verse 7. Verse 7. He said, you offer polluted bread upon mine altar. And ye say, wherein have we polluted thee? In that ye say, the table of Jehovah is contemptible. When you offer the blind for a sacrifice, it is no evil. And when you offer the lame and the sick, it is no evil. Now, I want you to note, that's not a declaration by the Lord. Don't leave that in prayer. That's what they were saying. We can offer the blind, we can offer the sick, and there's no problem with that. He said, present it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee? Or will he accept thy person, saith Jehovah of hosts? Now I pray you, entreat the favor of Jehovah, that he may be gracious unto us. This hath been by your means. Will he accept any of your persons, saith Jehovah of hosts? Oh, that there were one among you that would shut the doors, that ye might not kindle fire on mine altar in vain. I have no pleasure in you, saith Jehovah of hosts. Neither will I accept an offering at your hand. For from the rising of the sun even to the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles. And in every place incense shall be offered unto my name, and a pure offering for my name shall be great among the Gentiles, saith Jehovah of hosts. But ye profane it, in that ye say the table of Jehovah is polluted, and the fruit thereof, even its food, is contemptible. Ye say also, behold, what a weariness it is. And ye have snuffed at it, saith Jehovah of hosts, and have brought that which was taken by violence, and the lame, the sick. Thus ye bring the offering. Should I accept this at your hand, saith Jehovah. But cursed be the deceiver who hath in his flock a male, and voweth and sacrifice unto the Lord a blemished thing. For I am a great king, saith Jehovah of hosts, and my name is terrible among the Gentiles. Now, this is not a verse-by-verse study of the book of Malachi, but I want you to look at their attitude. It prevails through the book. They were serving the Lord, but not joyously. Even in the bringing of the wrong kind of sacrifices, they weren't bringing the best. They were bringing that which was about to die anyway. And even then, their attitude was, oh, what a weariness it is. Now you plug that into Psalm 100. Make a joyful noise unto Jehovah, all ye lands. Serve Jehovah with gladness. Come before his presence with singing. Does Malachi chapter 1 indicate that's what they were doing? No, that's just completely unacceptable. And you see this thought kind of beginning over in the Psalms 95. But look at verse 3 of Psalm 100. Psalm 100. He says, know ye that Jehovah, he is God. It is he that hath made us, and we are his. We are his people, and the sheep of his pasture. Now the point that we want to see in Psalm 100 is to learn who God is. And we said that there are a number of things that are presented in the Psalms. We see that there is comfort to those who are weary. We see that there is the presentation of emotion. David was angry when he met with oppression from Absalom and from King Saul. And so that's just a kind of a cross section of the many things that are addressed in the Psalm. But what I want us to see just here is that we cannot worship and serve God acceptably until we first know who he is. We've got to know who he is. And that's foundational. Now, let's take that thought, if you will, with me, please, to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. Wasn't that the fundamental problem that we read in Romans chapter 3? They did all these terrible things because there was no fear of God. Well, why didn't they fear God? They didn't know who he is. In Romans 1, in verse 18, beginning, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hinder the truth and unrighteousness. Because that which is known of God is manifest in them, for God manifested it unto them. For the invisible things of him, since the creation of the world, are clearly seen, being perceived through the things that are made, even his everlasting power and divinity, that they may be without excuse. Let's pause right there. How do we explain all that is? How do you explain even the intricacies of the design of your body that we're going to deal with when we get over to Psalm 139? How do you explain the design that you clearly see in what is about you? How do you explain that without God? Now, this troubled me for a long time. I've studied with folks who doubted God or doubted the existence of God. And how do we explain what is? The element of design demands a designer. And we know that that's not man. Man didn't do that. Man don't have the power nor the knowledge or the understanding or the ability. Many of the things we've discussed in our studies of evolution and things of that nature, we have shown that those who are schooled in the sciences did not know, did not even begin to know until more recent times. We talk about Aristotle and Galileo and characters like that. They're in our history books, they're in our science books, and we say, look what they discovered. And yet we know that many of the things that supposedly they discovered is revealed in the book of Job that lived about the time of Abraham. And so if you want to know that there are paths in the sea, you know, the man that discovered that, what was his name, Magellan? The man that discovered that did so because he heard his son reading the Bible and noted that there were paths in the sea. He said, well, son, read that again. And he set out to discover them. And the same paths in the sea are used by shipping merchants today. Paths in the sea. Springs in the ocean. How do you explain that? Man didn't have the means to find springs of fresh water until the invention of a very specific type of submarine that had autopilot on it, or a joystick, so you could go down there and look at it. But the Bible talks about paths in the sea, and it talks about springs in the deeps. How did the fellows that wrote that know that? You see, we look at the creation that God has given, and here we come away with an understanding of who God is. But these in Romans chapter 1, they said, no, we know better than that. There is no God. We know better than that. There's not a God. And it tells us that they were without excuse because that knowing God, they glorified Him not as God, neither gave thanks, but became vain in their reasoning, and their senseless heart was darkened, and professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Well, there you got it. How do you explain all the junk that men believe and all the evil practices in which they engage? Well, we don't know who God is. Now, the point being made here is know that Jehovah, He is God. And what we want to do with that is we want to make some comparisons next week from what men did in Romans 1 by creating idols and worshiping them with what the Bible tells us about who God is. And you might find it interesting to read over in Psalms 115 about what an idol is. And Isaiah, what is it, 44, I think it is, where we read about what an idol is and why men made them. Okay? So we'll start with that next time.